You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I feel very honored to be hosting that episode, a hopefully summary and suspenseful one. So I'm joined here today with my co-baristas, Julie. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Hello there.
And I just want to start you off on a question that is kind of key in the present day, present moment. Have you been back to the cinema? And if yes, did you see any great and convincing and interesting characters in the first movies you have seen?
I have not. I think cinemas are opening here on the 3rd of June. So by the time this episode has aired, I may have, but I haven't as yet. And I'm not sure what's on. But at some point, we hope in the future, there will be a Bond, in which case I will watch Bond. And that's an interesting character, if ever I knew one, right?
Well, I mean, hopefully it'll be a little bit before that. I think it starts in October. So I really root for cinemas opening earlier for you. And you
yeah.
Know. How about you, Matt? We've been more lucky in Switzerland with cinemas open now for a few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been, what, 3 or 4 weeks? And already I think I'm in the double digits.
Wow.
They showed a couple of older films that I was very keen to see at the cinema, like Fargo, which I love, and which, of course, has great characters, like most Coen brother movies. Singing in the Rain, also great, fun characters. The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Oh, wow.
But in terms of more modern films that we've seen that have great characters, we watched Thomas Vinterberg's Another Round, that won the Oscar, I think, for best foreign movie. And that one has great characters, especially the character played by Mads Mikkelsen is just so engaging, and Mads Mikkelsen is just so good in it. So definitely can recommend that on the strength of its characters and everything else.
Right. I wanted to mention that character too. His Martin is really fabulous.
Sorry.
So it's no problem. It's the first movie I've seen. And of course, it was such an impressive experience to be back with people reacting to the movie, partly laughing and then, of course, partly not laughing in that movie. And I think the other one I've seen, female character, main character in Promising Young Woman.
Oh, yep.
Cassandra, played by Carey Mulligan, who is a fantastic character as well. It's just the way she starts off as this, you know, innocent and slightly strange girl that seems like too old to be a girl living with her parents. And then you get that whole backstory of her past and why she still is so girlish and at the same time starts to take revenge for something that happened to a friend of hers. So two great characters, actually, and just realizing what cinema can do. So today we're actually also going to talk about a character that is very, very memorable and has appeared in different shapes or forms over the past decades. So one that has featured in a number of film adaptations of widely different origin. And his creator, famed American crime author Patricia Highsmith, has been filmed and has been adapted in with many of her stories. So from Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train to Chabrol's The Cry of the Owl to more recent The Faces of January or Carol. Highsmith's plots and characters lend themselves ideally to many different filmic adaptations, both in American and European cinema. But there's one character in particular that hasn't only repeatedly featured in more than 5 of her novels, but whose first appearance has sparked widely different adaptations in cinema. The mysterious and multi-layered killer, impersonator, and escape artist Tom Ripley. And I think it's rare that characters outside of movie franchises reappears that often, and especially if he's a kind of a psychopath. So there must be something about Ripley, something particularly talented. And I think today we wanted therefore to look at the two famous film versions made from Highsmith, The Talented Mr. Ripley. The first one being Anthony Minghella's 1999 adaptation starring Matt Damon, and the second one, the French 1960s Plein Soleil, or Purple Moon in English, by French director René Clément starring Alain Delon. So we wanted to ask ourselves, can there be really two great movie adaptations based on an already riveting novel? And what are the strengths and weaknesses of projecting Tom Ripley's character onto the screen? So maybe as a first question to the two of you, looking at Ripley the way you saw him in movie adaptations or maybe also in the novel. Is he a likable character? Do you like Tom Ripley? And how did you feel about him?
I mean, we are supposed to like Ripley. I think that's a trick of the book. I think that's Highsmith's trick, is that we get drawn into his life and into his manner of thinking, and we're supposed to like him. And especially, we'll get into that a little bit later in the Mingela film. Ripley is intensely likable, but he is a complete psycho. You tend to forget. So do I like Ripley? No, I do not like Ripley. Ripley is one of these people where once you find out what the hell is going on with him, you run away very quickly. So, but it takes you a while to figure out, despite yourself, you might still like him, right? He's so very compelling, but maybe more compelling than likable. Yeah.
Matt, did you feel the same way about Tom Ripley?
Yes and no. There's definitely some stuff that resonates with me in what Julie just said. I would also agree he's not immediately likable, depending on which variation we're talking about. He is fascinating. And I think, especially in the older film, which we'll talk about more later on, obviously, and in the novel, it's interesting to watch him the way it's interesting to watch a slithering reptile that's preying on tiny, cute animals in one of those BBC Ultra HD nature films. I don't think he's quite a human being, and I don't think he's quite supposed to be. I mean, Julie mentioned that he's a psychopath. I'm never quite sure what the right word is. Is it psychopath, sociopath? We did two episodes on this a couple of years ago, and we still didn't define it.
Yeah.
But I think Tom Ripley, especially in Highsmith and in one of the film versions, he's less a character than he is an absence, an emptiness that is filled with bits and pieces of character. And that is fascinating.
Well, that's an absolutely fascinating image that I have to think about it. Never thought of it that way. But definitely, I agree with both of you that he's absolutely fascinating in each of the versions, but for very different reasons. And I think you're right, Matt, in saying that in the book version and in the French early version, we're kind of more rooting with him because of everything that he tries and achieves, and he locks in, and he's so talented at forgery and impersonation. And I think that's what makes us root for him, because we want him to succeed, because he seems to be so riveting and so cold at the same time. And we want him to get through with all these things just because he does it so well. And then Mingela makes it much more difficult for us not to like him. I think Matt Damon, it really comes across as likable, and we even pity him for certain things. We want him to succeed also emotionally. We want him to find connections with people and kind of get out of that basement that he's shown in repeatedly in the film. So I think that's what makes it much more complex. And I think Mingela really has a different take on Highsmith's character, because he puts in a lot that is not there in the book. And I think that's why we root for him. That's why he's likable, but then by the things that he does, he becomes absolutely disgusting. So I felt torn in each of the versions, but especially in the 1999 adaptation. We've already talked about the two adaptations, so maybe it's a good moment to quickly introduce each production and maybe mention their main features, give a bit of introduction to the style and the feel of the films. Chronologically speaking, I think, Julie, you looked into Plein Soleil, Purple Noon,
yes,
a bit for us.
Yes, I did.
What is there to know?
Oh, there's so much to know. The one thing that always strikes me with these really famous films from this period, especially European films, is that our listeners, or even myself for that matter, may not know anyone who's in it, apart from Delon, who is so stunningly beautiful. As you say rightly, Sam, you don't really root for him as much as you are drawn in by him, because he's so blank and he's so positively gorgeous. But interestingly, for instance, Maurice Ronet, who plays Dickie Greenleaf, we don't know him anymore, but he was a very prolific actor. I mean, he was in, I think, about 60 films in about 20 years. So he just kept making them. I think probably his most famous one would be The Fire Within, which again is not something that survived to this day. But he was a very famous sort of face. And the same thing goes, and she's probably more well known, for Marie Laforêt, who was, apart from an actress, a very sort of talented and successful singer-songwriter. She wrote songs in the folk style, but also just really poppy stuff. And I think we've talked about this film before, the film from François Ozon, Eight Women, very weird musical sort of film. One of those songs is hers. Mon Amour, Mon Ami was hers, was Marie Laforêt's. And because the universe is completely unfair, apart from being an incredibly talented artist, she is also stunningly beautiful with the most incredible eyes, which they use very well in the 60s film, the Plan Soleil film. What is also wonderful about it, the photography, is that we get to go to places. So the film's Montebello, which I don't even think exists anymore. This is a sort of a decor that is of its time. So in that sense, quite apart from Ripley, it's a fascinating film to see because of the images of the landscapes and the cityscapes that you get to see in the Highsmith herself based Montebello on a town called Positano, which I've never been to, but she was very charmed by. And this, in my mind's eye, this is how I picture it as it is in the 1960s Plan Soleil version. It's absolutely stunningly beautiful. But I think the core of this film is that we go with Delon on his adventure, defrauding people, changing his identity and trying to become Dickie Greenleaf as much as he can. And it's not as detail-oriented as the Minghella one. This is a very sort of straight-up crime thriller. Highsmith herself liked it. She saw it. She just hated the ending. She said that the entire point, spoilers from here on in, the entire point is that Ripley is supposed to get away with this stuff. And not sort of it being implied that maybe he might get arrested. This is Tom Ripley, guys. He doesn't get arrested, right? And the rest, I think you have to see it for yourself because it's so cinematic and beautifully, beautifully short. Is that I can use a lot of words, but I think it's just so postcard beautiful that you have to see it for yourself. One interesting little tidbit is that the screenwriter, Paul de Golf, is interesting to look up in and of himself. He is probably the least nice person that I've ever read about. He was so not nice, in fact, that his wife shot him, I think. So there's a lot of background in this. This is just, not to be gossipy, but just to give you an idea of this world and this film and the time it was made and the characters that were involved is like a world all of its own. So I suggest anybody to dive into it, you know, grasp it with both hands and read up a little bit because it's really worth it.
Thank you, Julie. And I think to me, it seemed so fascinating that it was a film version that came out shortly after the novel. And it feels like it is still set in that world. It didn't need to be recreated. That world still existed that the novel talks about.
Yeah.
But it did feel a lot like a Delon vehicle and maybe a star vehicle for him to create his image as a star somewhere between really attractive and then also cold. You know, I wrote down cold as a fish. And of course, those images are mirrored in the movie as well, in one famous scene. So I felt it was very much a vehicle for Delon, maybe even for René and Laforêt as well, a French star vehicle, a crime thriller of which there were many. And of course, also a showcase for Clément. I think we can talk about that later on, his visual style, the music he uses. And I think it felt very much of that French cinematic era in many ways, and less a straightforward adaptation of Highsmith. I think, Matt, now if we move on to a quick look at the Minghella version, 1999, I think he was much more invested with the original material and worked on it very thoroughly. What were your main takeaways from the Minghella version? What do we need to know about that one?
It's a strange one. I mean, in some ways, it's definitely closer to Highsmith, but I think in terms of its heart, it's much further from Highsmith. And it's much further from Highsmith because it has a heart, which is, I think, not there in the novel and it's not there in the earlier film. It doesn't have to be there. I think what Minghella does is he takes the plot, but in a weird way, what we get is almost like a revisionist retelling of the story. Let's perhaps just quickly to say a couple of things about the actors. I mean, it's also a star vehicle. You've got Matt Damon. You've got a very young Jude Law, Gwyneth Paltrow, a very young, disconcertingly young Philip Seymour Hoffman, Kate Blanchett. And I think most of them were relatively early in their careers, or some of them were already stars. Some of them were just kind of stars in the making, like Jude Law, who was had basically done stuff like Gattaca. He'd done Existence with Cronenberg. Matt Damon, of course, had done Good Will Hunting, which I think is when he became big, really big. Gwyneth Paltrow had done films like Emma, for instance. So you have all these stars, young, pretty, beautiful, gorgeous, in, of course, equally gorgeous landscape in Italy. It's a much warmer film. I mean, both of these films, they're set in a kind of warm landscape, obviously, in a place that we associate with heat and summer. But I would say that the French film is chilling, where the Minghella film has a warmth in its images, in its colors, that is there throughout. But I would even go further, and this is where I found when I rewatched the film, I really liked it when I first saw it 20-odd years ago. Rewatching it, I actually came to almost dislike it, which is interesting. And I think the thing is that Minghella, what he does is he makes the talented Mr. Ripley, he adds pathos, and in doing so, he makes it sentimental. And I think that sentimentality to some extent betrays what was there in the novel, what Highsmith does. And of course, I think an adaptation can be a retelling, and I do think there's a, you know, in a way, I find myself reminded of things like Wicked, you know, the musical or novelistic retelling of the origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West. You know, let's take a complete sociopath, a murderous sociopath who basically steals people's identities and takes their lives. And let's make him sad. Let's make him tragic. Can be interesting. I came away from it this time around feeling that Minghella almost tried a bit too hard, because we are so much supposed to feel for this Ripley. And I'll cut this short at this point, he says, after talking for a long time. the one thing that Minghella does that I think makes all the difference is, in Highsmith, there's subtext that Ripley is gay. She herself kind of denied that. She said, you can't pin him down like that. He's not gay. He might be bisexual, but basically Ripley is Ripley. But it was there in the subtext. I think, you know, you cannot deny that. In Minghella's version, I think the sexuality of Tom Ripley is much more in the foreground. It's much more central to why Ripley does what he does. But it's also one of the things where I'm not quite sure it works that well for me anymore. Because I think, in a way, what we get is the tragedy of Tom Ripley who can't get what he wants because he's gay at a time when you can't be gay. I'm not sure that works with the more sociopathic elements, but I'd be curious to hear what you guys say.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a quick reaction, I think just like the 1960 version, the Minghella version is also a child of its time. And I think the fact that he stressed the gay aspect, the possibility that Ripley actually is homosexual and is not just using the people around him to, you know, further his plot or further his goals, I think has to do with the times that it was, Highsmith was read as covertly homosexual in her novels. And this aspect was then brought out into the open. And I remember when the movie came out, that was an aspect also talked about in relation to her writing. And of course, in relation to the film version. It's interesting that you reacted negatively to the version this time. I had the opposite effect, not for the same reasons, but after having just read the novel and looked at it in detail, I thought it was just a fascinating adaptation in so many details of the novel, in its elements. Everything is there that Highsmith put in there, but he added more. It was almost like he took the novel, tried to pick out almost all the elements down, you know, to the fridge and the perfume and each location, each moment is present. So it feels in structure very much like Highsmith is fully there. But then he added that tragedy of Greek proportions. I was reminded of that. Mm. Very often he adds maybe what you call pathos, this level of absolute tragedy, personal tragedy for Tom Ripley, a person that is closeted. I think he puts him again in that basement very often, and in these basement-like rooms. He also talks about that at one point. And then wants to kind of free him, and this tragedy of not being able to free himself from that darkness is what he shows in the film so often, even by including the Peter character much more than he ever is present in a novel. So I felt I was really touched by that, and I remember also being touched by it when I saw it. But maybe you're right, maybe that's not the goal that Highsmith had in the novel. He's not a character that we're rooting for emotional reasons, like we said before. But I was really taken in by that, by this tragedy of him not being able to break free, that in the end he has only one solution, that is killing, to get to the next level, because he entangles himself in that web of deceit, and that's tragic. But it's a different reading of what is there on the page.
Yeah, I think with Minghella, what is so tempting, and I do this, is to project Highsmith on Ripley somehow, right? To not take Ripley as she wrote him in the current age, day and age, but to somehow project a little bit of who Highsmith was onto this Ripley that was created. And I think that is what Minghella does. Highsmith was, in her own words, queer. She was a lesbian, basically. And she writes about this at length in Carol, for instance. So it's not something that she was very closed about, but she was very conflicted about it. She herself was. And I think the mistake that Minghella makes, if it's a mistake at all, is to weave Patricia Highsmith's very complicated character into the emotional realities of the Ripley film. And because she is so complicated, it's so, so tempting. But Ripley, of course, is another matter altogether, because all of these sort of troubles he finds himself in are self-inflicted, right? It's not something I can excuse, in the sense that it's sad, of course, it's tragic, but he does it to himself with such tenacity that it's not even like a spontaneous, I don't know, crime of passion. This is calculated. So in that sense, we are sort of equating Ripley with Highsmith herself. And I think it works on an emotional level, but I don't think it works as an adaptation necessarily, however fascinating it is.
It feels like, you know, on the blueprint of the novel, he then did his own thing. And if you hear him talk about it, he makes little reference to the Highsmith novel in detail, but he talks a lot about how he expanded on that time, on that era, and on the characters, even by adding new characters like Cate Blanchett's character Meredith, who is a mirror image of March. And they become like two couples that play on off each other in the course of the film. So I think it was just fascinating to me that he took whatever was there in so much detail, but then was able to make something that feels completely different. And it's interesting how you felt about it, Matt, that you reacted so differently to that effect that it had, to that extension of what is there and partly isn't there with Highsmith. I was wondering if we should talk about one central relationship in the story, that is the one between Tom Ripley and Dickie, or Philip Greenleaf, as he's called in the French version, because the gay aspect, the homosexuality, is played on very, very differently in each version. We talked about Minghella's version already. How did you feel about that relationship and what it's like in the French version by comparison?
Yeah, in the French version, to me, and this goes back to other writings that Highsmith has done, it's not so much that Ripley is somehow in love with Dickie or Philippe. He wants to become him. This is also the sort of entire text, subtext of the murder. This is a usurpation of his identity. This is not just, oh, I love you and you don't love me, you die. No, this is a complete usurpation of his identity. So in that sense, I think it's very hard to call it gay subjects, because it's not about love at all, or even perhaps not even about attraction that much. It's about an ideal of life that Ripley wants to have for himself. Dickie has it. He wants it and he takes it, and he usurps Dickie completely. He wants Marge for that reason, not because he likes her, because he doesn't like anyone. But he wants her because she's a part of that sort of lifestyle and that sort of personal brand. And in that sense, the French Ripley, so Alain Delon's Ripley, reminds me very much of Patrick Bateman in American Psycho. And I know I promised you guys I wouldn't bring this up again, but it's the same sort of, it's not about the people. He doesn't love or like Philip Greenleaf. He wants him. So I think that's an interesting, there is of course chemistry between the actors and it's very attractive to watch, but I don't think it's about love or attraction primarily, which it is in the Mangella, it totally is.
I think I would agree with that. I do think that it's been decades since I read any Freud, but I'm sure that there would be lots of things that from probably Freudian theory that would fit here. I think with Tom Ripley in the French version, what we have is to some extent a narcissist. There's these constant mirror images. They are in both film versions, but I think in the French version, it's less about, you know, who am I, losing your identity, remaking your identity, than it is about Tom Ripley in that one is a reflective surface. And there's this scene relatively early on where the boys are on town and they're, you know, it's basically boys being boys with all the ugh that implies. And you've got Philippe. I will probably keep calling him Dickie because I think the name is very fitting. So you've got Greenleaf and Ripley picking up this woman, probably drunk woman, and not quite having sex with her, but fondling her, kissing her. And it's almost like the woman in the middle is, again, a mirror. You've got on the one side, you've got Philippe Greenleaf, and on the other side, you've got his reflection. You've got Tom Ripley trying to imitate him on the mirror that is the woman. And the woman doesn't matter. I think in that respect, I wouldn't even say that even though Alain Delon comes across as heterosexual, I think Tom Ripley comes across as, I don't know whether he is a sexual being in anything other than imitating, as you said, Julie, the Philip Greenleaf that he wants to be, that he wants to become. You never get the impression that he's actually really attracted sexually. At least I didn't.
To anyone, right? It's just opportunism. Mm-hmm. And his obsession with being someone else. Yeah.
And I think in the mirror scene, doesn't he kind of kiss the mirror? So if anything, he is attracted to himself or what he could be, what he could become.
That's a stunning scene, by the way.
It is.
Just for our listeners, he dons Dickie's clothing and his tie, and he does this little flirtation in the mirror with himself that he's so in love with himself being Dickie or pretending. And of course he gets caught, which is like this tense moment where Dickie starts to realize that something is up here. Yeah.
And it's a key moment, of course, in the novel as well. It's really, really important. Dickie seeing Tom in his clothes and realizing that he's probably, you know, trying to impersonate him. And there's completely different implications in each version. I would even argue that the 1960 version is wiped off any homosexual context. They even, you know, add Marge as much more of a love interest at the end, even though of course he also uses her only for his plans. I didn't even find there was chemistry between them. I thought it was much more of a competition with Dickie realizing that Tom was cheating with bank statements and finances very early on, and then really becoming hostile towards each other. And I felt between René and Delon, there is kind of this aggressive tension until the murder that happens at a completely different stage and under different circumstances in Plein Soleil. In the novel, at least, there is the suspicion that Tom is a homosexual from Dickie's side. And he even teases him about it and speaks negatively of homosexuals that they see in San Remo just before the murder. There is at least that, and Tom's reaction to that he feels somehow put down by that. But I think in all versions, he mostly uses people to get to the next level. And once they become a problem, once they don't fit his storyline anymore, he needs to get rid of them. Mm. And I think the only difference here being that the Mangella version makes a tragedy out of that, whereas in the book and the French version, it feels like that's kind of a game, a puzzle piece to get to the next level. And then he escapes again, until maybe he doesn't escape.
I think that's why, or that's what I would do. That's why they always stick on the first book because it's the Ripley series is a series of books, and the most interesting adaptations are the first, because there's still some conflict there. In later books, Ripley is just a complete criminal, basically. And just his conversion to amorality is just apparently the most interesting story in the series to tell, right? Because it keeps being the first book.
And looking at the films, you couldn't think of a second movie.
No.
There is no space for a sequel, it feels, because, yeah, Donald is just caught at the end and that's it. He probably goes, you know, to prison for a long time. And with Matt Damon at the end, he just seems like crushed and caught in his inability to do anything else than murder. I didn't see any space for the stories to continue in the vein of Highsmith, him becoming older and a sly killer impersonator and fraudster. I don't think that's at all what he is at the end of Little Helen and Mr. Ripley.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, both films fail, right? Because they're both not entirely Ripley, in the sense that Ripley goes on with his fraudulent games for books after book after book. And in the film, you feel like there is no way to go on from this point. There is just no, it's either you're caught in your web of lies to such an extent that you sort of wither and die, or you get caught eventually. There's just no way out. And in the books, there certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, despite being very different adaptations and very different takes on Highsmith, each of the films has its unique flavor, its unique qualities. And I think that's what made it fascinating to me, that even though we might have different takes on what Highsmith was, but both movies are standout movies for their own reasons. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit more about each of the movies' qualities and how they also interact with each other. Because this time around, I felt that Minghella doesn't only use the Highsmith background, but he also makes cross-references to the Delon version. And they are somehow texts that speak with each other, or movies that speak with each other that have nothing to do with Highsmith. So I don't know how you want to go about this, but what are some standout qualities in each of the films? And maybe, Matt, I'll ask you this time about Blanc-Soleil first, and then Julie about Talent Mr. Ripley. Maybe we can go about it like that.
I would say that when I rewatched Plein Soleil, I found it much more fun than the first time. It's fun in a cynical way, in a kind of bleak way. But I think the movie excuses us for enjoying what we're watching, because the thing is that Philippe Greenleaf is such an entitled bully with little to no redeeming features. So when he's killed, and he's not killed, it's not a crime of passion. It's not some kind of weird kind of self-defense as it is in the other film. It's very calculated. I mean, they have a conversation where it's never quite clear to either person how much are they joking, how much are they telling the truth. Which is about, you know, okay, Tom, what are you going to do now? Well, I thought I could kill you and basically steal your identity and your money. And there is, once you basically accept that this is amoral to the core, it's kind of enjoyable, because you want to see this Philippe Greenleaf, not perhaps not get stabbed, but you're perfectly okay with him ending up kind of as a corpse in the Mediterranean. You don't feel for him. You don't, you know, you actually think that if anything, Marge is better off without this guy. Mm. So while it's a chilling film, it's kind of chillingly funny in the darkest possible way.
Yeah, I agree. It's such fun watching a man get away with something, right? It actually works for quite a long while. And you're like, oh my goodness, it's going to work. He's going to take over the entire identity, the money, the girl, everything, right? So that's a lot of fun. I absolutely agree. And with René Delon dynamic, there is something there that I would call chemistry in the scene that you just described, Matt, but it has a lot to do with, I don't know, a sort of adrenaline junkie type of attraction, mm-hmm. right? Where and I think this speaks to René's talent, is he manages to be kind of excited by the prospect of being in this amount of danger. He doesn't seem properly cowed by the fact that this guy would not bat an eye and kill him where he sat. He just doesn't quite believe it, and he thinks it's quite exciting, and he thinks he's on top of it somehow. And then, of course, you know, the bell rings and he's gone. I think it speaks to the talent of Ronet as well as Delon, that they managed to make that so spectacular, that scene, where I couldn't get away with it. I would look like a scared little rabbit, and that would be it, right? And it wouldn't have worked. So there's something there that they're looking for excitement too, or at least Greenleaf is, because he always is, because he gets bored like within 2 seconds of anything that he undertakes. I don't quite agree with Matt that he's such a dick that Marge tries to, you know, redeem him a little bit and says, oh, he's not like this when he's with me, right? Like famous last words of every battered wife ever. With me, he's different. I can fix him. But I think there is some fun to him as well with, he just tries anything and he just doesn't care what anyone thinks. There is something there that is attractive, even though he's not a nice person, obviously. So I wanted to point that out because it's a role that's so easy to forget, because Delon is like the sun. He's the king of this film, but Ronet does very, very well in holding his own.
Absolutely. And I think what's fascinating in that version is how that scene, how that build up of that tension is concentrated on the boat. How that location is much more at the center of the drama unfolding, or the murder then taking place. And I think that's a standout quality for me that the movie had, that it was able to pitch these characters against each other in a lengthy scene that is set on Dickie's boat and up until the fallout with Marge, when Philippe Dickie throws out her manuscript into ocean. Which is a horrible thing to do. So I would disagree with you, Julie, that he's likable. To me, he was just like unlikable from start to finish, but certainly attractive. And then there's almost a reason more for Delon to kill him. You know, he has that, he uses the same knife, and they even practice using a knife before that. So it's kind of a foreshadowing. He cuts the sausage and then he cuts.
Talking about Freud
at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
There you are.
So one standout quality for me that it was that Clément was using the ocean and the solitude of those three and then two characters to build that tension up and almost to give Tom the reason to, or the final straw to kill off Dickie, and then we don't really care about Dickie anymore being dragged in a back, you know, behind the boat, of course leading up to the final moment as well, the final revelation. So that was a quality for me in Plein Soleil, and also that they used the Mongibello house and village much more than it actually is in the novel and the 1999 version. I felt very attracted to this world. And these returns, also, of course, supported by the soundtrack. What you said before, Julie, that we feel we're always re-entering that nostalgic world. And at the same time, of course, horrible things have happened in and around this world. So locations played a big role in that, or main locations in the 1960s version. Standout qualities in the Minghella version. I'm going to hand this back to Julie for a bit. If you watched the movie, what were some main features that you loved?
Well, my first sort of, I had the opposite reaction to Matt. I'd seen it ages ago, more than once, and I always liked it. But now that I saw it with the podcast in mind, my admiration really grew for the film, even though I think it's flawed for the reasons Matt already enumerated. But the first thing that struck me was his eye for detail. The details in this film, it's just smashing. Like you said, he's sort of referencing, in already the opening credits, he's referencing the Plein Soleil with the little vistas that he does. And also the boat, again, the boat as a sort of prison, right? You're so trapped on that boat in the middle of the ocean, there's nowhere to go. And his visual, his eye, I don't know whether that's him or the DOP, but his eye for these ocean vistas, again, the vistas of the village, it is so gloriously, overly beautiful. You don't believe it really exists. And this gives Ripley another dimension, because he lives in this world that isn't quite real. So the level of detail in that, and again, the apartment with the statue of, who is it? Is it Socrates? No, it's not Socrates, right?
It's Hadrian, apparently.
Is it Hadrian? Oh, cool. You actually know this sort of stuff, Sam. That's why we love talking to you. But the level of detail in the acting as well. And for instance, a character that stood out much more in the Minghella version was Philip Seymour Hoffman's Freddy, where he is almost a plot device in the first film, in the Plein Soleil. In the Minghella, he is an actual rounded out character. So these actors make something out of nothing, out of thin air, that is so memorable, and all these little details and the way he approaches it as an ensemble cast rather than a Tom Ripley driven crime thriller. It's really, really fascinating to see. It's absolutely beautiful.
Matt, you were less enthusiastic this time round. We've already heard that, but what would you say is admirable about the Minghella version?
It's definitely a lush, beautiful film to look at. I mean, I talked about The Pretty Young People, and I think it's beautiful to look at on all different levels. I think in some ways I realized this time around I would almost have liked the film better if I just switched off the sound, switched off the dialogue, and just looked at the images, because I think the images, they're gorgeous to look at. There's a kind of old school, almost classic Hollywood lushness to them in the warmth of the light and everything, the costumes. I think in some ways, you know, the apartment that you mentioned, Julie, that Tom Ripley then kind of sets up, he is like, you know, his own set dresser. It's like, you know, the film is in love with this world that's not quite real as Tom is. And that's totally there. Mm. I also think that, you know, there's a lot of great performances in the film. While I'm not too keen by now on the writing and therefore on the Tom Ripley character, I do think that, for instance, Jude Law has never been as amorally attractive as in this film.
Mm.
And he is. I mean, especially if you mostly watch American films where there's this kind of rugged masculinity, and then you've got Jude Law, who, while he in the film, he's, I think, very much heterosexual, you can still see that anyone of any sexuality would find this guy attractive. I also think it's a fantastically fun part for Philip Seymour Hoffman, even though it might be the most horrible character he's ever played, but he's just having so much fun playing this horrible character. And obviously, I think, you know, the Italian tourist board might have, they were probably on their knees, you know, thanking Minghella and God and everyone for this film, because how can you watch Minghella's Talented Mr. Ripley and not want to go to these places?
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with this aspect of the glorious look of the film, recreating, and specifically recreating 1958. I thought that was so fascinating, including the San Remo music festival, jazz festival, really going for that one specific look. And I think we'll talk about the music a little bit later, but I would agree with you, Matt, that Jude Law as Dickie Greenleaf, I mean, he was the standout character. If you talk to people back then about what they thought of the film, many, many people mention him as Dickie Greenleaf. And he was such a literal poster boy in that, you know, movie poster that was all around the cities as Dickie Greenleaf, even though his character is killed off after one third of the film, I guess. And then Tom Ripley's so central and he's in each scene. I think the focus very often, the sum in that film is not like, you know, Delon, like you said before, Julie, but it's actually a Jude Law.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a very different relationship to him in this movie version. And I certainly also agree that these references to the 60s version were spot on. Julie, you mentioned that the opening scene when, in just very condensed fashion, Minghella induces Tom Ripley's New York life, which plays a much bigger role in the novel and was supposed to play a much bigger role in the 1999 version as well. But he then makes this title sequence kind of an homage to Maurice Binder and Saul Bass of the 1960s. Of course, the title sequence of Plein Soleil is made by Maurice Binder. So yeah. that I thought was a fascinating cross-reference here, just to be geeky about that.
He's done his homework, that man. He's done his homework for sure.
It's incredible. I've talked about it already to you guys before, but if you didn't appreciate the movie version as a movie, you have to listen to the commentary track by Minghella. It's so lucid. There's so much thought that went into it. It's almost impossible not to like the film after that, even though you might disagree with the interpretation. So I thought those were really standout qualities of the Talented Mr. Ripley, apart from the characters and or the actors playing these characters and their young point in their career where they're at, and they're all really strong, I thought, in small and bigger roles, down to the minute characters like the inspector or the different side characters that appear just very briefly. So it's very, very detailed and very, very focused. Maybe the opposite question, you know, what is there not to like about each film? Should we go into that as well? The thing that you like least about them?
Yes, please.
I'll turn it around. Maybe just talking about Till End and Mr. Ripley first.
Part of it's already been said by Matt. I know the trick is that we're supposed to root for Tom Ripley against our better judgment, but Matt Damon is too likable. He's just too likable. And this is a horrible thing to say. He's a lovely actor and he does a great job and it's in the script. It's right there. But he is just, he's an everyman in quite a different way than I pictured him. And also, and this goes for both films, the ending, again, spoilers, but you guys are used to that by now, listeners. The ending, when he murders Jack Davenport for no other reason than that he is the one person who still knows that he's Tom Ripley and not Dickie Greenleaf, I wanted to feel angry. I wanted to feel in this film he's gone too far. And what we get is, and you'll pardon me, the same whiny self-entitlement that Tom Ripley has displayed throughout the entire film. Namely, I have a right to happiness, I have a right to riches, I have a right to this lifestyle and this personal brand. And I was like, I thought it was handled as a tragic accident and not something that Tom Ripley willingly does to a person who obviously loves him. So I thought I wanted Ripley back, like the old Ripley, the bad, nasty Ripley that I can root for without any guilt or shame because he is a nasty piece of work. And sometimes nasty pieces of work are a lot of fun to watch. And not this sort of, as you say, Sam, exactly, this Greek tragedy, almost Oedipal tragedy, where you are fated to kill the one who still knows who you are in order to subsume another's. It was too much. It was just too much. And I think as good as Damon is, he was an entitled little whiny person, which when that started to seep into my brain, I couldn't unsee. And I was like, you wanted to go to Cortina for skiing and you took it for granted that you would be paid to go to Cortina for skiing. Why? And he's so upset when he doesn't get to go. And I'm like, yeah, but that doesn't make, you know. So I think there are little flaws that creep in there when you start thinking about it, which is to say that I also agree with the general public ideas that probably Dickie Greenleaf is the strongest character in there because he's very consistent. He'll try anything once, including sex with Tom, if it enters his mind. He doesn't care. And he just wants to jump out of that plane. And in the end, he gets killed because he's annoyed by Tom Ripley. That's enough for Ripley to kill someone. He is found annoying, right? So there are little flaws in there. So that's my negative feedback. On the whole, if you can suspend your disbelief, it's really beautiful and worth watching. Just don't think too much, right?
And at times it can get too much also in terms of the layers that Minghella wants to add to each scene. And you were talking about this final scene, which I was really, you know, riveted by and touched by, because I really went into that tragedy. I really felt for Tom Ripley and then that murder he had to commit to somehow continue his story and not be caught again. But then in addition to that, he adds this Cain and Abel theme, you know, with the lullaby playing, Sinead O'Connor singing a lullaby for Cain. And then there's even a biblical reference in addition to the Greek tragedy. So I think it can become a bit too multi-layered and maybe thick, especially if you think of the criminal background of the story itself. And I thought that might be the biggest problem with it. It tries to add too many of these layers. Minghella maybe put too much thought almost into it and wanted to make it this massive emotional impact that takes so much away from what Highsmith intended.
Yeah.
That's the biggest flaw that I see. And I think, Matt, you would probably agree with parts of that.
Totally. I think the problem is that the layers that are there, to some extent, they don't click for me. They don't work together. You know, there are scenes in the film where Tom Ripley is presented as a psycho. There's a scene relatively late when it looks like he's about to kill Marge because she might find out what he's done. And there he totally is played as a Hollywood movie psycho bad guy, and she's the potential victim. that doesn't gel with me with the scenes where Tom Ripley is exactly the poor, sad, tragic, closeted homosexual who can't have what he wants. I think in some ways, if I'd come away from the film feeling that I can make up my own mind about Tom Ripley, I would have felt better. But Minghella does drive it home. You mentioned the lullaby for Kane, the song. And I mean, the lyrics there are so heavy-handed. It's this cast into the dark, branded with the mark of shame of Kane. And in some ways, I think the film is a bit schizophrenic. It's torn between wanting to be prestige drama with psychological depth and realism and complexity and nuance and being a Douglas Sirkian melodrama. And in some ways, I think, especially with Tom Ripley more openly gay, going for the Douglas Sirkian melodrama might have almost served it better. I think the film works best for me where I feel I can make up my own mind about Tom Ripley. And I think in that respect, I actually agree to some extent with Dickie Greenleaf in the first part. You know, Tom Ripley is clinging. He is needy. He is a leech. And none of that has anything to do with him being gay or attracted to Dickie. It's all about how he expresses this. And he expresses it as if he was a prepubescent girl to some extent. And if I feel free to be annoyed with that, I'm also fine with it. But once he's on the run, once he starts this affair with Peter Kingsley Smith, I feel the film no longer gives me that option to feel ambivalent about Tom. The film pushes me to feel sad for this poor guy who can't have what he wants. And that's where I kind of turn against it to some extent.
Yeah.
I think much of that also has to do with how it's supported by its soundtrack, by its score. The fact that we feel so intensely with Ripley in that last third where we don't only want him to get away with everything that he does, but we also want him to be happy. We want him to get out with Peter and start a new life. And I think the music there is also melodramatic. It's emotional. They even have a bond over music. Classical music becomes their mutual thing, whereas Dickie was the jazz kind of guy, and Tom tried to get into that world of jazz, but never really managed. So I think music plays a big role in heightening that identification with Tom Ripley and that drama at the end. And then the lullaby is almost the epitome of that and feels too much at the end, like you said. Now, maybe weaknesses in Plein Soleil. I was immediately reminded of the music as well, which is a little bit all over the place in Plein Soleil, but I don't know how you felt about that. Is Julie maybe asking you, is Plein Soleil in a way also a weak movie to you?
It is in the sense, I think, again, the ending. I mean, you can't do that. It does not work for Tom Ripley to get caught. It's one of those things. The fun in the movie is to see him get away with it. People. And I know there's a convention that bad guys have to get caught, but come on, that is total bull, right? And anyway, it's French, so they should be able to get away with anything. No, I think the weakness is that in essence is quite shallow. As you say, Sam, the music is very beautiful, but it doesn't take us anywhere, really, apart from being pretty. The plot is very straightforward, which I think fits Highsmith because she has a great clarity of writing. She's a very clear and succinct writer, so in that sense it fits her very beautifully, but it's not a film of very great depth. And sometimes it is a little bit difficult to know how to feel about this, right? When, for instance, grand scene, then Dickie's body is found and the game is up, you know, and you're just watching that like, oh, I see. So what's he going to do now, right? So I think that there is a risk there. In order to keep it fun, it has to be a little bit shallow as well. And Sam, you are completely right. As far as the soundtrack is concerned, it is a tiny bit all over the place. It is also, in honor of its screenwriter, quite a nasty piece of work in a way. It could have been made by Polanski. I don't think the last one is a flaw necessarily. It's meant, it's built in. But I can imagine someone looking at that and going like, oh, wow. Okay, you know, I think it's fun in the same way that I think American Psycho is fun, but that is what it is, and it's no more than that.
It's a shame because I'm in admiration of Nina Rota's work normally in film, and here I felt it was confusing. sometimes sappy and emotional, and then there was this tarantella playing. And during the scene that you mentioned before, Matt, in Rome at the very beginning, where they're doing all these pranks on the blind man and this lady in the carriage, there is this constant soundtrack that is gets so much on your nerves, and you don't know how to feel about anything. And then suddenly you were back in sappy Mongibello, and I didn't know how to feel about that. So it has a lot to do with, I think, the use of music. And at the same time, it being such a nasty film. And one scene I wanted to point out that I felt is so crucial in the novel and is in each film is the murder of Freddie Miles. And in the Delon version, wow, that is such a horrible, yet at the same time, fun scene to watch with Freddie. You know, it takes so long to take the body of Freddie downstairs and into the car.
Yeah.
And there's these priests passing, and there's steps on the stairs, and it takes forever, and Freddie just looks really pale and dead. It's an awful scene.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Minghella version, it's relatively short. We don't really get that effort that Ripley needs to make to get rid of the body. So I thought the interpretation of that was really interesting. And I felt these scenes were much nastier in the Plein Soleil version. But in combination with the use of music, it just felt weird. Fascinating, but weird.
Question for you, Sam. Did you have the sense, because I don't know if I'm right about this, that the music was more pertaining to the location and the decor than it was to the characters?
Yes, I think taking Nino Rota, you know, from his use of music in Fellini, he's well known to use all kinds of partly source music, partly local music, and not really create a soundtrack for a scene so much as kind of the flavor of a certain place or time.
Right.
And I mean, Minghella does a similar thing with using original jazz from the time, classical music. But there's also a score that really goes into the emotions of the scene that is really befitting whatever is supposed to be felt. And Rota is more like coloring, flavoring each scene, sometimes over a long period of time without real reference to the scene. That's how I felt at least about it.
Yeah, oh, totally. I think to some extent it's the Italianita that he provides. He sprinkles Parmesan over everything, but then everything tastes a bit like Parmesan. I do agree that there, in that respect, the music in Minghella's film is used much more knowingly, much more consciously, perhaps to some extent almost a bit too much. Again, you know, turning drama into melodrama, but there is an effect that's clearly aimed for. And I think with Rota, the effect is really very generalized.
There was one point I wanted to bring up in connection with that, because as we said, Minghella has a tendency of layering things too much. And I recently read the biography of Chet Baker and his life story. And an interesting reference is, of course, that Chet Baker's music and even the record, one of his records Chet Baker sings, is in the film repeatedly.
Yep.
When Ripley goes into learning jazz, learning all about jazz. And in the biography, you learn that almost exactly around the same time, Chet Baker was actually imprisoned in Italy, in Lucca.
Okay.
For drug possession. And I felt that Minghella was even making reference to Baker being a slight Tom Ripley type character. He was a big jazz musician in the US, but then kind of became infamous because of his drug use and a suspected murder of one of his friends. That was never proven, really. But then at the time that Minghella sets the story, I think Baker was literally still in prison or at least very, very famous in Italy. And I thought there was a layer of that, that jazz musician, similar to Ripley, his music use, and of course, all kinds of music use to show the fascination with jazz that Italy had at the time, especially American jazz, but also adding another dimension to the Ripley character through music, or in that case, also Dickie's fascination with jazz and his saxophone playing at the jazz club.
Yeah, I believe you, because he throws in everything in the kitchen sink, doesn't he, a little bit? I think this is a fascinating hook, because I'd have to read up on it. But if I look at the history of the French film and the characters involved in that, there's also one, you know, who was murdered. And so there's this sort of real life bleeding into fiction type. And this is also what I said at the very beginning, is that I feel that he pulls in Highsmith herself as a sort of reference point So, yeah, it gets a little bit confusing. But I love that bit of trivia, Sam. It's quite possible that he knowingly did the Chet Baker thing.
But I mean, the Chet Baker thing also offers itself with respect to the scene where Tom sings My Funny Valentine, serenading Dickie Greenleaf. Again, a scene that I remember I liked it a lot the first time around. And this time I thought, again, if it was Douglas Sirk, it would work. But I think Minghella is too keen on being prestige drama. And I think there's a lot of camp in the film that I don't think the film is always quite aware of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it goes so far into the melodramatic, fated aspect of this. Yes, of course. I mean, there's this little scene, which I love personally, where Tom is rejected because Dickie and Freddie are together, very close together, yes, sharing headphones in a music booth, listening to music that they're both enthusiastic about. And Tom is not. And Tom is literally shut out. And then there's this sort of, I thought it was almost funny, but there's this sentiment between, you have to think this is sad, right? You have to feel sad for poor Tom that he's been shut out of this world. And I'm like, it's very hard not to sort of smile wanly and go like, dude, what were you expecting? What did you think was going to happen the moment that Freddie drives in this red sports car yelling ciao at everyone? You know that you are not in this world. You don't belong here, right?
I think that's what I preferred about the Plein Soleil, about the French version, that it left things for you to discover.
Mm.
It wasn't presented to you on a golden platter. There's a lot of moments, especially visual cues, that you can see or you can ignore. And we briefly talked about this scene on the fish market that I think is just key to that, where he walks around and you might see, you know, all the dead fish and you might get the reference, okay, dead fish, like Dickie's death and maybe the guilt that he feels. But Delon doesn't seem to feel anything. So we don't know if he actually feels guilt or if he's just marveling at the, you know, display of fish. And there's, I think, a scale at one point that he sees, just a very brief glimpse, 1 or 2 seconds. And you think, okay, reference to justice or not? Is it really putting us there or not? But it's not really wanting us to, you know, to go in that direction and to see things and to have the music also support that feeling of guilt. So I don't know, I read somewhere that Highsmith was inspired by Dostoevsky, but I felt that in a way, yeah, the Minghella version much more thickly layers on this idea of guilt and possible redemption. But I think that was too much again.
Correct, yeah.
And the Plein Soleil version gives you options visually.
Yeah, it was crime and punishment. So Highsmith was very interested in crime and guilt and that sort of thing anyway. And he was an enormous Dostoevsky admirer. You're completely correct. And crime and punishment does have a lot to do. Again, Minghella is trying to be super clever, isn't he? He's trying to be too clever by half. I think that's in there. Yeah, I think you're right.
But I think the thing about the guilt, I mean, I think it's definitely layered in with Tom's, you know, homosexuality. And historically, it would make sense. This is, you know, the 50s, whether you're in America or whether you're in Italy, basically, you couldn't be openly homosexual. But what I found was that in a way, this 50s setting was rather superficial, but because with respect to Tom being gay, you rarely get the impression that that really bothers anyone all that much. I mean, you've got this scene where they're on the boat and, you know, Tom is glum because Dickie has a new friend and Marge comes over to him and has, you know, a chat girl to girl. That's what it feels like, you know. I know you're jealous, but, you know, that's just what he's like. And there you totally get the impression she knows completely that Tom is in love with Dickie. Even when Dickie gets annoyed with Tom, it doesn't feel like gay panic, which is what I kind of expect. In the 50s with this guy who thinks he's the, you know, manliest man ever, that he would be like, ugh, you know, get away from me, you homosexual, you. But there isn't that. It's not that. It's, I think Dickie is still kind of flattered that Tom would, you know, be into him. He just wishes he did it in a less annoying way. And then you've got Peter Kingsley Smith, who, I mean, you don't get the impression that it's extremely openly lived, his homosexuality, but at the same time, you also don't get the impression that it's very much hidden. So the closet seems to be very much one of Tom's own making, not one of the world itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether even the drama, the tragedy would have worked better for me if we had had the strong impression that this is a world that does not like homosexuals, this is a world that beats them, that punishes them, that kills them. And then obviously Tom is forced into certain actions, but the guilt and the shame seems to come entirely from him and not from the world. And that struck me as really odd this time around. I don't know how you saw that.
Yeah. What they omit is that the kind of world that Tom Ripley is aspiring to is also the kind of world that may be more tolerant in that sense. And they don't even hint at that. I mean, in Highsmith's own day, she was queer, as she called herself, and everybody knew that's a thing that existed. It's not that people were completely blind and thought that, and it was a very dangerous thing to be. But in certain circles in the arts world and so on, it was just something that you did not speak about too much. But there were women who were obviously sort of kind of living together, or two bachelors between quotes, that sort of shared a house, sort of kind of, even though one of them was quite married, you know, that sort of thing. And I think that is something, I agree with you, Matt, that's something that the film, Mangella's film, should have touched on, is that this is also a circle and a world in which Tom Ripley has a much better chance of finding love. This, of course, is completely absent in Plein Soleil, where he just wants money and he doesn't really care who he has sex with anyway. But, in a sense, is asexual, right? Who knows? Who cares? But in the Mangella film, it's interesting because he's so detail oriented. It's interesting that that doesn't come up at all. And it's only something that is in Ripley's head, his own prison for himself, which is a theme in the film. So I get that. But it's strange that it's not touched upon at all.
I feel that each of the film versions is not free enough to do that. I think the problem with Mangella is that he was sticking too closely to the plot of the film and then expanding on it from there. So he didn't add that layer to it. And the French version couldn't in 1960, I feel, add that layer to it, didn't want to. And I think one problem is also Delon. I'm sure one of the aspects of leaving that aspect completely away from the French version was the star image of Delon at the time. As I said at the beginning, it feels like a vehicle for him. They even put his then-girlfriend, Romy Schneider, in there in a very brief scene at the very beginning.
Little cameo.
Because they were a famous couple. So obviously, for, I guess, reasons of the time and the morale of the time, but also because of the image they wanted to portray of Delon, that was not possible to do. So in a way, each of the film version doesn't feel free to expand on that aspect of it.
Yeah. Also, in the 1960s version, it bears to keep in mind that Highsmith was still alive, and she might have sneered at it. She might have said that you're completely missing the point if you make this about sex. So I think the film is also just conscious that Highsmith is going to see it. And she is this really famous writer who wrote the book. And I think if they made it overly subtextually gay, she would have balked. She would have just said that's just silly, right? Just stupid. And she was a very abrasive person. So I can imagine that they were like, well, you know, let's keep it under the water there.
I mean, I don't think it's completely absent. I think, again, I talked about Freud earlier, and I think especially in Victorian times, there was this notion of homosexuality as being a weird form of narcissism. Men who are in love with men, women who are in love with women, they don't seek the other. They seek something more similar to the self, which is, of course, a completely rubbishy way of looking at it. And, you know, let's not listen too much to the Victorians. But I think the mirror imagery hints at that somehow. As I said, I don't think that Alain Delon's Ripley is, that there's anything homosexual to him, but he is narcissistic in a way that I think the Victorians would probably have looked at that and gone, ah, we get it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, it was actively seen as, however horrible this is, it was actively seen as a disease that you went into therapy for. So it might have also muddied the waters in 1960 in that sense that people wouldn't have seen it the way that we do now.
And talking of the, you know, signs of the time, we mentioned 1960. By 1999, when the Mangella version came out, I think having openly gay characters in mainstream cinema was still quite rare.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, I remember the movie was quite talked about because it did hint at that, or it did more openly show that towards the end. But I was wondering, we're now 60 years after the French version. We're around 20 years after the Mangella version. So if there was a new version of Ripley coming out today, would that make for a different adaptation, a different film, or what adaptation should there still be of The Talented Mr. Ripley?
I hope so. I hope we go back to the complete psycho that we all know and love. There's a series in the offing, isn't there?
Yes.
I read something about it, and they're going to do all the books. And this is something that I can get excited about. I think we can go back to Highsmith being the impossibly abrasive character and writer of supreme clarity and brilliance that we admire her for. We are allowed to make Ripley a complete bastard. It's been tried. I think Malkovich had a swing at it at some point. And that's closer to what you would want. And then I would like this really beautiful young man, just as beautiful as Alain Delon, being a complete asshole. It's almost like Mads Mikkelsen's Hannibal Lecter in that series. It's so scrumptious, and he never has a pang of conscience throughout the entire thing. It's absolutely glorious, and I hope it goes that way. That I would love that.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because we know a little bit about casting already, and they cast Andrew Scott in the role of Ripley. So it gives us a bit of an indication which direction the film might take, even though Andrew Scott, of course, is very versatile as an actor. What did you think about, or what do you think about that prospect, Matt, of having a Ripley series with Andrew Scott in a title role?
I think he could definitely pull it off, because he's very, very good. At first I thought, you know, he's Moriarty and he's fantastic as that. But at first I was a bit, you know, startled when he was in other roles. But then, you know, he works perfectly as a sexy priest. So I think he can do pretty much anything. I do think you could now do something that has the nuance, the complexity and the depth of what Minghella was aiming for, but still has the teeth and the nastiness of Highsmith. And I think that combination would be great. I mean, Julie, with you mentioning Hannibal, I love that series anyway. I would love to see something like that. But I would possibly disagree a bit that, you know, back then it wouldn't have been possible, because this is what I've been threatening you when we were having all these preparatory chats. I do think that we have a very similar story to The Talented Mr. Ripley in 1950s, all about Eve. It's not about murder, not literally, but you've also got a young woman who basically is of ambiguous sexuality, who is an identity thief. You have the same kind of mirror imagery. You have Eve Harrington in All About Eve, who wants to be the Betty Davis character, but she also kind of wants her. There's the same kind of class issues. And that film, it has the cynicism and nastiness and the dark humor of a Highsmith. It's all subtext. It's all sublimated. So obviously it was easier to get that through the senses as well. But in that one, I found that if you look at Eve Harrington as a kind of Tom Ripley character who almost gets away with it, we're not obviously asked to feel for her. We're not asked to show sympathy for her. She is quite horrible. But because they don't try to soften the blow, by the end of it, I actually feel sympathy for her, even though she's the devil. So I think you could have done that even back then. Nowadays, you can definitely do that. But I think nowadays, especially if they do show Ripley as a homosexual, as openly homosexual, depending on how they do it, if it's an English production, there's a risk that they think, oh, well, we can't show a homosexual character as being too negative. We have to also give them sympathetic sides. And to some extent, I understand that. But I think it might, again, pull some teeth from Ripley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I have a pet peeve in here? Because it annoys me. I always worry that they are not going to have a gay character if it's not all about being gay. If the film is not specifically about either being gay in a specific era or in a specific circumstance. I mean, you could make a film in which a character is just gay, and also there's lots of other stuff going on. This is something that I think Hollywood should get better at, and I hope they do, because it's really, really annoying. I don't know how you feel about this, but it just gets me every time.
Well, I look forward to seeing that new version for sure, but I'm also a little bit worried that, like you said, in this day and age, there might also be limitations put on the Ripley character, and that we'd also are going to be made to feel a certain way about him that he's not in the original novel. Because, as you said today, we tend to want to feel positive about progress of acceptance and tolerance. And that might be then an issue of, again, hindering us or making us feel a certain way about Ripley that that we just don't when we read the novel. But I'm looking forward to it. I think I will be excited, especially after our talk today, to see the new version of Ripley. I think it's been delayed because of the COVID crisis. I think it's been finished in 2020, but it has not been released yet. So I'll have to wait and see and maybe do another take on that once we've seen it. So is that the moment to wrap things up? Thanks a lot, Julie and Matt, for taking us through adaptation. I thought what was fascinating today was what adaptation means in terms of different times, different approaches to an already strong novel that offers a lot of cinematic moments, but then making them into two very different products, but that also speak to each other over time. So I thought that was really fascinating. So thanks a lot for doing that with me today.
Thank you.
It was a great chat.
And join us another time when A Damn Fine Cup of Culture goes on the air.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.